All right, this is the Cosmos Cafe on essentially universal basic income. Forgot the title that I gave to it. That doesn't matter. But we had a little discussion before the recording came on about, well, everybody's somewhat heard of universal basic income. Most people are interested in this topic for one reason or another. I guess I personally first heard about it about 5 years ago when I started a job that's within social work related to it's an assistance program helping out those in need. It's another welfare program called TANF, or a specific branch off of that. Called KTAP here in Kentucky, but TANF is transitional assistance for needy families. But as I've worked in this job, I've and heard about universal basic income, I've been on kind of both sides of the issue, ranging from, well, this wouldn't. That there's arguments for and against UBI. Some of the obvious ones are there's a huge divide, perhaps a bigger divide than has been in recent history within perhaps the past 100 years, maybe even 300, 400 years of income inequality, and where the masses tend to have very low income, and there are a select few, the 1%, that have a majority of the income, and that this inequality creates all sorts of other divides, ranging from health problems to anxiety. The clear one is financial issues. Which ties into family time or free time to even choose the job of your liking. And so there's a lot of pros for universal basic income. Some of those against it also have good reasons for why they believe that this would not be a good idea. One would be a lot of the proposals for basic income means completely revamping the welfare system in place, which would be not just a simple switch. That would be quite a lot of congressional action and decision making and years of policy and whatnot. And there's also, once we look at the numbers of there's a lot of people saying we cannot afford it, at least here in America. It's been spoken about for the earliest that I noticed that I read about was, well, I guess there's Christian idea of charity, and that's those poor schmucks over there are needing food and need. So we need to help them. So that's the private charity. Maybe that's more of the conservative side, ranging into utopian thinking. Thomas More in his Utopia book mentioned some sort of, well, let's just give food and money and I think land to each individual. That would be a nice happy place. But it's trickled in and out of both the conservative and the liberal side of politics. And now, within this presidential election, I think in February last year, Andrew Yang, he's running on the platform for universal basic income through various. He has quite a few proposals. There's value-added tax. There's other which would be value-added tax, is essentially a sales tax of sorts. But I don't want to get into all the acronyms and all the various crunchings of the numbers, but he does have a point. Another aspect that he's concerned about, that he noticed in his kind of his small scale, what sounded pretty large, was Venture for America, which was essentially taking college students and grads into cities with need and providing jobs there to, or providing access to cities that were in need of kind of the higher up college educated individuals to promote job growth, to promote various economic gains for these communities that were either hurt by automation, and that's the big term that Andrew Yang is speaking about, that as more and more jobs become automated, this is the fourth industrial revolution, and it's not only affecting the lower folks, like factories are being automated, but there's also all the way on the high scale thing, doctors' jobs could potentially be automated with do-it-yourself medical exams, or a lot of surgeries are done now by machines. I don't want to take too much time by describing more and more of all this. And I would like to hear from just an open frame here, hear from everybody, whether you want to start with how you first heard of it, your thoughts on it. We could go political. And oh, that was a note from Marco. So he's got two appearances here. So we can see you now, Marco. Or at least I can. So that's about all I had to say at this point. I could go on and rattle on, but
I can jump in there.
I know John and Barrett and Davor and TJ in the two generations conversations they've talked about. That's has come up in both conversations as the just a reasonable direction towards kind of this post-capitalist society.
I'm not going to be going in a reasonable direction. I just want to warn everybody. I'm going to be profoundly unreasonable. I want to bring our collective attention to something that's happened recently. The burning of Notre Dame yesterday. And probably, I'm looking for some kind of correspondences and images that we might share that goes beyond ego to ego. That has something to do more with a shared culture, perhaps even a sense of a shared civilization. My response was very visceral when I saw the collapse and I and the fire, and I screamed, which really surprised me because I didn't think I cared that much about Notre Dame. But evidently, on some level, I cared a lot. And I saw all kinds of images. I had been to Notre Dame. I took a tour of it. It made a very large impression upon me. Looking at all the statuary and the stained glass and the rich history that I had read and that I'd seen in the movies. I saw the Hunchback of Notre Dame. I saw Charles Laughton playing the Hunchback, swooping down on a rope to grab Esmeralda as they were getting ready to hang her. And he flies with her back to the cathedral and he carries her over his shoulder on top of the cathedral and he holds her up, her live body, and he's shouting, "Sanctuary, sanctuary!" And that to me is what Notre Dame is a profound symbol of, is sanctuary, which was a deep sacred space for those medieval peoples. Of course, when they were escaping oppression, they often went to a holy spot like a cathedral where they could find sanctuary. Just as there are many in our own, many refugees around the world who are flocking to different shores seeking political asylum. I think that principle of sanctuary runs very deep in us. So I want to draw upon quantum poetics, which we've already established here. We've done a lot of exercises using that principle. And what would happen if we move towards a quantum politics, a politics that is not dominated by Newtonian physics? So I'm drawing upon that those practices that many of us have engaged in a different context, and moving it into another context. So the questions I have are, what will happen if universal basic income happens? What won't happen if universal basic income happens? What won't happen if universal basic income won't happen? And I'm expecting that we could draw upon different alternate ways of knowing this issue and create a cognitive blend from those alternate ways of knowing, and that we could probably start to move out of that classical Newtonian grid, which only recognizes bodies as physical, into something that includes our minds, which are not physical. They are different from the physical, and the mental arise out of an underlying reality, which is neither physical nor mental. This is very quantum way of thinking. And quantum mechanics has, you know, been around only 100 years, and I think it's not understood by very, very many people, including myself. But I do sense that our minds, when minds share a language, those minds are hopelessly entangled. So we can't separate anything neatly into subject-object little heaps. And I think this becomes inflamed, these differences in our politics, which I think are, we're in a transition, moving from a very Newtonian kind of model to something that's more quantum, deals, I think, with the affective zones, which are neither here nor there, quite in between, and recognizing that we are both, and we are both physical and mental, and neither physical nor mental. We're in the in-between, just as in those fascinating experiments, which are still puzzling people. How do wave and particle, what is that mysterious relationship? And I'm suggesting that we are a wave function, and we're collapsing through our observations and our mutual observations. We're all observing systems, and we're observing each other's observing. But we're quickly, and this is being amplified by our media, that we're quickly moving into something else. But this something else, I don't think any of us can define, but I think it's way beyond the Republicans or the Democrats. And I believe we're getting lots of environmental pressures, like the dying of the oceans. 20% of the oceans have, coral reef has died in the last 3 years. And how many of us are going to stay in a politics of fight, flight, freeze, and how many of us are going to be able to entertain some alternate ways of knowing and probably see and seek some different kind of blends. And that's a very tall order. I think it's a daunting task. And it's also going to, we're going to have different kinds of relationships that we're going to have to pay attention to. I think we have a long way to go. I think this is an interesting proposal that this candidate for president is making. I like that he says, let's draw upon the best of capitalism. Let's draw upon the best of socialism. I think that is already something new in our politics, which have been rigidly defined by for or against. And I also want to just open up another set of questions. I hope this leads someone to a eureka. The United States of America. Where is the United States of America? What kind of United States of America is that? Does that United States have a size or a shape? And what does United States of America, as the oceans are starting to die off, want to have happen? And my suggestion here is, and this is a little bold and a little wacky, I know, but that the United States of America is much more like a hologram of Statue of Liberty, Wall Street, wheat fields in Kansas. You know, I can see the Golden Gate Bridge. I'm sure all of us will have different kind of images, but can the images that we share create a sense of coherence, a coherent we space, which is because we have not found a coherent we space. I think our politics has been caught up in a downward spiral and in the arrested development of actually a few people. I think there are many more people who are ready to move beyond and perhaps already have moved beyond this kind of us versus them kind of vocabulary. But I think we have a long way to go before we can develop those potentials. I'm all for the human potential movement, not the human achievement movement. I don't think we've achieved this yet. And I think it'd be incredibly hubris to think that we've come close, but we're getting a little closer, I think, by just having this kind of debate about universal basic income, which I think is something new. So thank you for this opportunity, fellow citizens.
So while others are thinking about what to say, you mentioned the hologram, and I don't know how this ties in, but Andrew Yang will be participating in multiple debates as a hologram, just as a, is it a gimmick? But he's going to be able to be projected in different locations to make it seem as if he's really there, as has been done with musical artists. And there's concerts around these dead musical artists. So there's technology for you there. Kind of perhaps he'll prove a point. We'll see. But I like what you said, John. There's quite a bit there, and it takes it into the spiritual dimension, which I feel is left out of the politics. And I guess people have varying ideas of what spiritual means, but there's the dimension of just the well-being outside of money that each individual, each family, each group could perhaps access if we weren't tied into that model of the current economy, that the gift economy is perhaps the spiritual version of that. You're shaking your head, but it depends on what you mean by.
Please do not confuse me with the gift economy. I'm not advocating any of that. I'm doing something different, and I think Davor is too. But that's a long story. But I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just had to, you triggered me by that because I'm going to disconnect from that. Thanks.
So, yeah. Does anyone else want to chime in?
Yes. Can I say something? I find it very interesting, especially John's presentation. He starts with Notre Dame, which is a non-American event. But it's something that actually does touch a lot of people who are not French. You know, I've been to Notre Dame many, many times. I had to do a lot of project work in Paris, and I never went to Paris and didn't go to Notre Dame. I'm not Catholic, but I went there and heard Mass in Notre Dame because it's a different experience than hearing it somewhere else, depending on what kind of Mass you're hearing. And I also found it very interesting that in the aftermath of that, one French billionaire immediately pledged $100 million for the euros for the reconstruction. He already made a specified donation to help rebuild whatever it is that was destroyed. And I found that interesting that a quote unquote money person would do this, but they're doing it in regard to something, as John pointed out, is not really all that material. Yeah, there's a building and there's structure and there's stones and there's wood and there's maybe even relics and stained glass and artwork and whatever, but it's not about that. That's not what motivated this person to do this. So that act of what's called a generosity or charitability comes from a different place. And that's where I agree very much with John. The topic of universal basic income is a global topic. It's not an American topic. That the Americans are going to talk about it in their own particular way is a given, because I think we can only talk about the things that we just can't talk about the things that we know, but we always talk about them from wherever it is that we are that we know. And so if we know that as an American, we will, you know, we talk about it as American. I find myself increasingly not speaking as an American. I hear the amber waves of grain and the Statue of Liberty imagery that John's bringing about, but that's not the image of America that most of the world has. To most of the world, America is a destructive force. It's, to use an Islamic term, it is Satan incarnate. It is viewed in a very, very different way. It is not seen as a benevolent entity. It's seen as another. So, yes, America has to figure out how they're going to do that, but this is also going to play out within a global planetary structure, because automation isn't limited to the United States, and it's not limited, you know, which probably has the least manufacturing of any modern developed country. Well, other than the Brits, they have none for all intents and purposes. The Americans have very little, and the Brits are even worse off, which is their big problem with Brexit. They have no way to support themselves. They can't actually function as an independent entity because they don't have anything to live from, if you will. And in a case like that, topics like UBI become very important. This is a topic that's been kicked around in Germany since probably in an active, open, public discussion where most people would recognize the acronym since the 80s. But we also live in what the Americans consider a welfare state. So the whole idea here is that if you are a citizen of the country, why should you starve to death in your own country? And how do you avoid things like that? And what do we all need to do in order to ensure that if there is something as national identity, which I tend to think there isn't, though I do understand what is meant by it when the word is said, we have to find other ways of dealing with it. So UBI or one of its variants, depending on how that is, comes up and it's kicked around. But it's one of those things that I personally am very ambivalent about, because as I pointed out the last time the acronym even came up, is this just a form of welfare? Is it a disguised form of welfare? What's the actual purpose and who's advocating it? Because, you know, Doug pointed out there seems to be a lot of controversy being generated, but when you look at people who are speaking for it, they come from a very broad range of positions. When someone like Milton Friedman speaks about it in any kind of, say, relatively positive terms, Milton Friedman is the Reaganomics hero. So when he speaks of it, why would he be in favor of that? What I found very interesting was the debate between Shapiro and, well, not debate, the interview between Shapiro and Young that Doug posted. I listened to the whole thing and I found it absolutely interesting, because here's two people who agree talking about something that they don't agree upon, but they're not talking about it in a way that, how do I say this? They both think it's the right, not a bad idea, but for very, very different reasons. And the reasons will probably undermine it more than whatever comes out of it. I also found it grotesque, I'll use that word, that Andrew Yang proposes this as a freedom dividend. That was to me the most offensive thing that was said in the entire interview. You're simply choosing a euphemism to describe something that we should be able to talk about as adults. So I think it's something we really need to be thinking about, but I think we need to be thinking about it on a broader scale than the national one. We'll put it that way.
Well, going off the last comment there, the universal part, how universal are we planning on getting or going with this? And I agree with you completely that this, if we look at capitalism, perhaps it's on a global scale. It's not simply a national issue. It's, if you change something on the national level, it will affect how things are done on a global level. So if you change, even though it's changing the welfare system of a country, there's a lot to consider about the global impacts of that. And that hasn't really been addressed by anyone I've come across. It's always on a smaller scale. And in defense of Andrew Yang, he is looking at a larger scale within what's already been done. So if he is elected president, he would be wanting to I think he knows it's not going to just magically be a, okay, let's switch over to this and we're good to go. But he's proposing a trial effort within some select state. He hasn't really completely identified which state that'll be. I don't know if you'll vote on my state to be the UBI trial, but right now it's only small scale on the scale of 1,000, 2,000 individuals in a trial experiment within a town. Or we see it with private charities in my home state, Tennessee. After the wildfires, I think a couple of years ago, Dolly Parton set up a fund, and that's considered basic income, to where she provided everyone in the area that was affected a certain amount of money to kind of bounce out of that disaster there. And that's great. But he's saying small scale charity, at least in that interview, he's saying small scale charity will not be able to help out on a larger scale. So that's why he's going governmental with this. That's why he's introducing it into the politics. And same thing with the Alaskan dividend, or the oil revenues, they receive a certain amount each year. It's much smaller than what's proposed. So if we trickle that on the national scale, how does that apply? But then again, what does it mean for country? Our version of poverty here in the States, at least, is nothing compared to what poverty means in the Philippines or in somewhere in Africa or a third world country, where people right now at the poverty level will have access to a phone, will have access to food and water for the most part. They might have to go through certain systems, but so what level of well-being are we talking about? Michael,
can I? Go ahead, Ed. I'm not faulting Andrew or Mr. Yang for the term itself, the freedom dividend. What I was actually criticizing, it just occurred to me when you started speaking, I didn't phrase that very well. The fact that you have to say something like that to talk about something so fundamental says something about the field or the environment in which you're speaking. That you can't call something what it is. It is a basic income. But saying that raises so many other hackles that people are forced to clothe this in terms that can become more obscuring and will be used against him. At some point, that will be used against him, I am sure, because we can't just talk about things anymore. So I'm not faulting him for using it. I'm faulting the fact that he seems to feel that he's forced to use a term like that to even be able to bring the subject up. And that's a much more fundamental problem, I think.
So trying to go to the fundamental level, I think what needs to be discussed from any point of view is what is your basic assumption of human nature? Because a lot of this is based on human nature and our assumptions of human nature. And speaking as somebody that has lived at the lower income and had to deal with it from the bottom up, I've had to look at my assumptions and be challenged. How do I talk to somebody else that thinks I'm a lazy, no good for nothing because I'm not living up to the standard they want me to? So if we're going to talk about it, this is a very important issue to me. If we're going to talk about it, let's talk about the real issue of how we view human nature. And a lot of the way we view human nature is we think anybody that's not living according to some capitalist standard is not worth giving any help to, other than through charities like that billionaire or whatever. And oh, God forbid the government tax the rich a little bit more to help the less fortunate. End of my soapbox.
I don't think that was so much a soapbox as an honest statement of where you're coming from, Michael. And I think it's legitimate to come from wherever we are. The fact that the billionaire made a donation, I wasn't aware of Dolly Parton's, by the way. I think that's a very nice gesture that she's made. But we have huge problems everywhere, but there are no charitable solutions coming forward from people who might be able to help. And so it falls on someone else to do that. And this whole idea that you talked about, Michael, or that you at least addressed in this capitalist attitude, isn't really so much a capitalist attitude. It's not really an economic attitude. It's a religious attitude. It's a Protestant work ethic. It came out of religion. It just didn't come out of the economy. It goes a lot, since we are speaking fundamentally, it goes a lot deeper and a lot broader than just the economic aspect of it. Oh, that's the one that's most realizable, and that's the one that you get to hear, because we've forgotten about the other part. We've forgotten about the part that the only way that a person is if they work, whatever that might mean.
If they what? I didn't...
Work.
Oh.
Work. Yeah. If they work. Work defines a human being in many respects in our modern society. And a person without work is seen differently. I noticed that when I retired. When people say, oh, are you retired? The expression on the, when you say yes, the expression on their face changes. You are seen differently because you are no longer positively contributing to something they think needs to be contributed to. That's my short circuit conclusion from what you see. I've seen people who assumed at the beginning of the conversation that I was a working individual. I don't have a lot of gray hair. John probably does more than I do. Yeah, well, don't laugh, Michael. You don't even have any. So I don't have a lot of gray hair. Most people think, for some strange reason, that I'm younger than I am and I'm still part of the workforce. And they're surprised when they, no, I'm retired now. And it's like, oh, so what do you do all day? It must be nice to have so much time. I don't have any time for anything. I have less time now than I ever had in my life.
Well, thank you, Ed, because you articulated, I like the background that you brought to it. Because
well, this is what
I've experienced.
I understand where you're coming from there, Michael, you see.
I've experienced having to be forced to retire because of my disability. And
for example, yeah.
And all through that, and you're right. I think you're absolutely right that it has its roots back into the Protestant ethic. And my pushback is sometimes is, you know, I contribute to society in ways that you can't put money on it. I lived with my father and helped him exist and care for him, and just being there so he wouldn't die of loneliness. And these are things that are intangible that I don't understand how the Protestant religion negated them, or they tend to negate, from my feeling. So thank you for articulating.
Yeah, okay. Well, to understand that, Michael, just to throw it in, you're gonna have to read more of the Bible. And then you understand how some people take certain things that are said there to justify certain positions and certain attitudes and certain
fair enough for
why things are a particular way. That's where Weber came up with to begin with.
Well, and I think it still ties into that. If we're going to look at these issues, we got to get down to the lowest layer. How do lowest fundamental layer, religious or whatnot, but you know, I'm inspired by what I've seen from TJ Post and you of looking at our assumptions in terms of the structures we're going to build, or, you know, that deep level of how we come up with structures to even, we got to look at our assumptions. Those come first before you lay the foundation, it seems to me. Anyway, Thank you, everybody.
I have more to say, but I haven't heard from Mark or Marcus. Would you guys like to chime in?
Just briefly, I had a conversation with my niece, who was a Alaskan resident for maybe, I don't know, the last 5 years or something. Now she's back in Colorado, and she tried to entice me to come up there to Alaska and help her build a home up there with the carrot that, oh, you get X amount of dollars, you know, just for being a resident of Alaska. I think the rationale up there was that even though the oil was extracted by a private company or a public company, actually Exxon or whatever, that the oil belonged to the residents of Alaska because it was a part of the resources of the state. So if you were a resident of the state, you should get some of the wealth that the oil generated, whether you worked or not, you sort of had ownership of it because it was a resource of the particular state. I don't know how that ties in to, you know, they talk about scaling these state projects. They always talk about that. I watched Andrew Wang, 3-hour interview on Joe Rogan. I really like Joe Rogan's approach to thing. I think he's probably the best interviewer of anyone. He listens, and I have not been convinced at all by Wang's proposal argument. I think he does not understand human nature. So I think it's not going to go very far. Particularly in order to actually make a difference for people, it'd have to be way, way, way more money than $1,000 a month. That won't do you anything. I think most of that money will go to alcohol and drugs. That's my feeling about it. And then you can say, well, maybe that's not a bad thing, you know. I'm not enthusiastic about Wang or his proposal.
Hey, can you guys see me or hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. So I've been going between my house, and I'm, as I said at the beginning of the call, not able to be fully present, probably because, really essentially because of economic concerns. And I'm not complaining about that. This is an optional event in one sense, but the reason I wanted to at least listen in and contribute a little bit if I can is because it touches to root concerns. And I was, you know, I've been a fan of the idea of universal basic income since I first heard it, mainly because, for selfish reasons, honestly, because I felt like I was, you know, working my butt off. I was, you know, really stressed out about money all the time. This is just from, again, personal and selfish reasons. And, you know, I could see around me that there doesn't seem to be any lack of resources or material abundance, certainly not in this country, but I would argue in the world as a whole, we have the means technologically, we have the know-how cognitively, and we have the resources materially to feed everybody and to provide everybody with the basics of a dignified human existence. And if that's, I mean, just at a very naive, simplistic level, like if I were an alien coming from another planet and trying to figure out, like, how do these similar looking creatures sort of manage their affairs on this world, I would say, well, it would just make a lot more sense if those are, if that's the reality of what's available to us, that we would find a way to take care of everybody. It just, to me, would make sense. But it doesn't make sense if you're within a certain frameworks and ideologies, and if you adhere to certain, let's say, religiously inspired beliefs about human nature and sin and virtue and you know, the worth of a human life and the worth of human time. I think that we're in a difficult spot because we've become dependent on various aspects of the nation state and the welfare state. And so the thinking that's going into, like, how to actually achieve what I think universally some level, some of us, many of us, and increasing numbers of us kind of know is the right thing to do, which is not to let people starve, which is to provide people with the basics if they're available. Even though that may cost the very successful some, you know, fraction of their wealth or some amount of their power, I think it's the right thing to do, and that the rightness of it can't be limited to or can't be kind of framed within the logic of the nation state. It's a universal idea and needs, I think, a planetary kind of solution. It would be great if one country, you know, was very successful, wealthy for whatever, because they had oil, because they had luck, for whatever reason, and, you know, were able to provide for their population. And if they were wise enough to do that, that would be wonderful. But that wouldn't ultimately assuage that moral impulse that would seek for human dignity on a universal basis. And so I think that, I mean, part of the dependency that gets set up when we're talking about the nation state is that we have to include some people and exclude other people. And so the logic of it is already set up kind of for conflict. Because let's say, just hypothetically, United States of America, somebody invents free energy or something like that. I don't know. Like some means of... then that would mean that people from other, as they already do want to, would want to come here and have a part of it. And we'd have to set up, which we do, our immigration policies and all that. I think that this is part of a logic of, I mean, this is part of a logic of kind of factionalism that in a, I'll put this in quotes, higher order culture, in a planetary culture, like, wouldn't really be the issue. Like, we would be finding ways to efficiently feed everybody, regardless of who profited from it. Profit would be a secondary motive. Like, profit would be kind of like who wins the baseball game, you know, between the New York Yankees and LA Dodgers or whatever. Like, that would be the level at which we would see it, because it wouldn't be existential. Whereas the situation we're in now is we have this profit logic where profit overrides every other value. And so if you threaten somebody's ability to make a profit, you're basically, you know, threatening their livelihood, their existence. But, you know, from here to there, that's a utopia, you know, I think that, like, if we don't know how to do it within the nation still, if the welfare state is not going to pan out in the way that the European dream had imagined, then we have to kind of hold out for other options. I was a little bit, like I said that I was a fan of UBI, but I heard a podcast, Douglas Rushkoff recently, and he had just some cautionary sort of perspectives on it. He was curious, and this, he didn't provide an answer to this, but he was curious why, when he brought up UBI to like the executives at Uber, you know, Silicon Valley, big tech company, like hyper-capitalist, rapaciously capitalistic. Why are they excited about it? Why do they think it's a good idea? And it's in some ways because it seems like the real capitalists see the problem with the system that they've benefited from, and they realize that it's not sustainable. It's doomed. Like if the consumer base, you know, of capitalism kind of falls out of the bottom of the garbage can, who's going to be buying all the products that we have to keep making to keep economic growth going, to keep the system perpetuating? So this sort of like infinite growth, this profit above all, it's like a mania, essentially. It's like a madness that I think UBI may be one way of kind of stepping back and providing a solution, but it could also be a band-aid. If you know, and $1,000 a month, really, it wouldn't go very far. It wouldn't necessarily provide that dignity. So I think I'm in favor of holding out for, not holding out. I mean, of course I would take $1,000 a month, you know, for free, but I don't think it would actually solve the problem. And so I'm curious what you all would think would get, you know, more practically get to that root issue.
So I did mention, and I think the last Bates and call, the Douglas Rushkoff, I didn't hear it, but I read about it in one of his some essay on the Medium website, just about how it's. I said it's more of a warning that if the big tech companies like Uber or Facebook are and Amazon are saying that, sure, UBI is a great idea, let's go forth with it. It's, I think in the interview, Andrew Yang kind of brought it up that none of these companies pay federal tax, I believe, or a certain level of tax. And that's a big issue. That's a big problem. But on top of that, Rushkoff is proposing not UBI. And he was kind of back and forth between the positives and negatives of UBI. But he's now saying what we need is universal basic assets, which was proposed by Marina Gorbis, I think. But I read just a brief manifesto of hers. It can be found on the internet somewhere. And it's saying there's not only what UBI would provide, but there's also what we know of as the commons of resources, which isn't tied into the location or meritocracy of, well, you just happen to have oil, so you receive this amount. But those basic assets that everyone should have, housing, food, shelter, and enough money to buy whatever is necessary based on how the economy is laid out. And she is also, Gorbis is also proposing a digital kind of commons as well, which is our data, which is currently being utilized for multiple millions of dollars for these companies, being sold off for advertising, whatever else. So our data, our digital currencies, our whatever else is out there that we do online. But of course, that's...
I think that's a great distinction. Rushkoff's distinction is really good because there's a big difference between income and assets, and between getting paid and owning. Right. And you know, like at a certain point, nobody owned anything on this earth up until, you know, the agricultural revolution, right? And then groups of humans began plotting out land that they then claimed as theirs and, you know, for their descendants, et cetera. And then just building out fortifications, and the whole kind of cycle started. And, you know, it's sort of communistic and whatever to critique the notion of property rights and ownership. But nonetheless, to me, that would be one of the things that we might need to rethink is, you know, who gets to own the planet? Who gets to own everything on it, all the resources that are in the sky, under the ground, the data that's coming off of our behaviors and bodies? Because right now, like you said, you know, that's just claimed. It's just appropriated by the companies that then get to, you know, use it to build avatars of ourselves, holograms of, you know, of who we are, essentially, and then figure out all the best ways to advertise to us, to sell us more things. So they would love for us to have just an income to keep spending money. But what that would mean is that they keep owning everything. And I would question that logic even before the income logic, because the income could be just another way to keep people enslaved.
Thank you all. I wanted to respond. This is getting a little confusing. On the call with Davor and TJ and Barrett, myself, I think Davor said that the modern is over. And I believe he was, I think many of us have studied Gebser and, you know, the archaic, the magical, the mythical, the modern era, which we're now in. And the idea that it may be over is triggering a lot of different responses from different groups of people. Some people celebrate this. Some people are terrified of it. And also I think that a large numbers of people are just in total denial. I look at I think it's the five stages of grief from Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who worked a lot with people who had terminal illnesses. And she would always say the first stage is denial. Then there comes anger. And then there comes, I can't remember what the next one is, something like despair. Then resignation. And then curiosity about what happens next. With lots of in-betweens and leaping forward and leaping backward. I mean, time is so fluid in those, if you've ever been in a death space with someone, you will recognize that time is not at all what we think it is in the more conventional frames of reference we use to get from one place to another, using calendars and clocks and other kinds of timing devices, which the modern has brought forward to a large extent in our public and private spaces. Because it's very hard for us, I think, to step outside of the relentless rhythm of capitalism, which is faster, 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 faster. It's all about the metaphor of a treadmill. And then there's another treadmill that's even faster. So you hop onto that one. Then you hop on another treadmill that's even faster. This is called innovation. And so we most of us have been on this most of our adult lives. And I'm just suggesting that we're coming up against it. I think we're running out of gas. Topsoils around the world are being depleted by agribusiness. Massive extinction, which is diverse species isn't just a great idea. Our stability depends upon diverse species. The whole predator-prey oscillation, the cycles of predator and prey, have to find a kind of rhythm, or there's a collapse. And I think this scales up to our social worlds as well. So I'm not here to really advocate for the universal basic income to sponsor it or not, you know. I'm just like wanting to use our imaginations to develop something that is useful. If we can do that, that would be great. I wanted to share, since we are split beings, this is, I'm becoming more and more convinced of, we're split, the mind and the body. And I think this happens, and I think this issue is becoming universal. I think this is drives a lot of globalization. I think some of this has been articulated very well by some of us already. But the idea of the quantum psychology, a quantum sociology, would be to recognize that the observer actually has an influence at the physical level. And at the mental level, the observer also has an influence. And there's something very interesting about when our awareness, for instance, of our unconscious reflects back upon the unconscious. The unconscious changes. And I believe this is happening socially, psychologically, environmentally, ecologically. And I believe a new planetary future would be very different from the neoliberal globalization theme, which we're all familiar with. So I think we're in this, in between these two possibilities, which we've not actualized yet. So I just wanted to share, I'm very much a believer in social dreaming, and I've actually initiated some social dreaming experiments here with Doug and with others. And I think you, Michael, you have, and so I think all of us to some extent. I just wanted to share something, a dream that I had last night, which I don't think is about me. I think it's about us. And I'm going to share it with you guys with the hope that we can start reflecting back. We can reflect on our collective unconscious. And as we reflect on our collective unconscious, we can change our collective unconscious. So in this room, this is a very long lucid dream. And I'm only going to extract from it one section of it. But this is sort of towards the end of a series. And then I'm in this room. It is a large round room with a semi-solid floor. It is stable, but feels transparent as a hologram. There is a tint of green. It's a green light that seems to glow throughout this in the atmosphere. And I notice that the room is crowded. I say to the group, there's a group of people, they line up on one side of the room. And I say, I want to write a story. Can someone tell me a story that I can use? And they say, that is not a very good idea. And I realize that I cannot abdicate my responsibility as the author of something that is quite impossible. And I realize that I am at the edge of chaos and I must make a decision. And asking a crowd of basically what I consider thought form, will not create a coherent story. And then I'm alone in the same space with two persons. One is a woman, she's in front of me, and one is a man who is behind me. And I turn my dreaming body so that the man is on my left and the woman is on my right. And I'm oriented in a shared space. It's a psychic space. It's physical and it's mental and it's psychic at the same time. And the man and the woman on each side of me are reclining on what looks like futons. And they're sort of floating there on their futons. And we're surrounded by this technology, which is all in this green tint. And I say, where are we? What is our relationship with the earth? And I say, we are in relationship with the earth. I declare that. Are we not? And they say, yes, we are. And then I indicate with a gesture, I am searching for a theme. Can you help me? And then I feel that the nature of this counter is like a spray of pixels on a swarm of something quite undefinable. And I'm asking them about this theme. I say, I want to communicate to the earth about this quantum stuff. And then I start to fade. I feel like the scene is fading, and I'm returning back to a 3D physical dominance, but with a sense of clarity that I know how to get, I know where I come from, I know how to get back there. So I'm hoping that through this awareness of our unconscious reflects back on this collective unconscious, we can change this. So I may be out of my mind, I'm pretty comfortable with that, but I'm wondering what happens to our politics as we move from a classical worldview to something like a quantum worldview, where we could see the others, another person as a version of myself, rather than as someone who's going to compete with me over scant resources. So thank you for this opportunity to dream socially.
Thank you, John. Because one thing I took from your presentation or what you were saying is we've got to get back to including more aesthetics and art and not just truth and goodness. I'm a firm believer in the true and the good and the beautiful. And I think we work from all three of those perspectives in one way or the other. I just like the sound of the words, to tell you the truth. The true, the good, and the beautiful. Sounds good, but we've lost touch with it because of just where we're at right now. But I have hope, or I feel that a lot of the ways that I frame what we're going through right now is the uncertainty of birth and death. We are giving birth and we're dying to something right now. And there's so much uncertainty. All I can do is participate with this group to help navigate my day-to-day life. Because today, the last few days, I've been lost in chaos of Notre Dame and everything. And I lost a good friend, you know, grieving. And so I'm just trying to find a way to have some sea legs in this storm that you articulate very well, John. Thank you.
I'm very sorry to hear about your loss, Michael. It's tough. It always is. And it's at times like this, I think, that we feel that uncertainty more strongly than at other times. But that uncertainty is always there anyway. But we can, most of the time, we can gloss over it and we can kind of, we think we have that idea that we are holding the demons of chaos at bay, even if we aren't. But it makes us feel good to think that we are. And one of the things that struck me, I'm going to take this back to a very mundane level for a moment, is in the Yang Shapiro interview, there was really no new thinking anywhere. We're assuming that the current economic system is fine. We're assuming that that how things have developed is what we need to deal with. An underlying assumption, I think, that is behind a lot of this is that there is there's nothing fundamentally wrong with the system that we have. All that we need to do is tweak it, and things will be okay. We can adjust the screw here. We can, you know, fine tune a vibration there, and the things will move on. But I think what Marco pointed toward, and this is what I also hear coming out of John's dream, it's much deeper than that. We have to go much deeper than that surface, let's fine tune the system kind of thing. And one of the things I appreciate about what DeVore is trying to advance is I think he calls it deep thinking, or this is at least the term I'm bringing from that discussion. We have to think more deeply about these things, because the way we generally think about things isn't helping us resolve some of the involved, or at least address issues that need to be addressed, because we tend to avoid as well. So we don't talk about certain things in certain ways. And we go on to, you know, business as usual, and will we have growth, and is the economy growing? You know, recently we had the World Bank and the IMF were together and said, okay, the world economic prognosis is now 3% growth instead of 5%, or 1% instead of 3%, whatever the hell it is, I don't know. But it assumes in all of that we can continue to grow in a finite space, which logic tells us we can't do. The same time that this conference is taking place, the IMF gives Ecuador $10 billion in loan guarantees, and Assange gets arrested. I find that odd. You know, there's obviously nothing going on there. But all of those things that we tend to think of as being parts of, you know, our freedom and our ability to, you know, they are so terribly constrained because we think within these constraints as well. You know, we also allow ourselves to be constrained. One of the problems that I think we have is that we're not, Terry Pritchard once said, I'll be more excited about thinking outside the box when I recognize that there's thinking going on inside the box. And, you know, and he's not completely wrong, but we do need to get outside of that, or we do need to break through. This is what I hear being said again. We do need to start rethinking things that we have taken for granted. The idea, for example, that property is theft is not a new one. Pierre-Joseph Proudhon in 1849 wrote an essay entitled just that, Property is Theft. You know, at some point, somebody just takes it and says, it's mine. And some nation state says, well, this is mine, and these are my reserves, and I can do it. Well, how did you get those reserves? You know, who actually owns the oil that's under, and gas, those great reserves that are under in the Arabian Peninsula? Are they Iran's? Are they Saudi Arabia's? How do you determine? Do you just like drop a line from artificially constructed borders that were made and say, well, this is mine and I can do with as I please? And this whole idea that I can do with property as I please is actually, as far as I can tell, a fully developed Roman notion. You know, this is where this first comes up. The Roman patriarch was allowed to do what he wanted with his family, and because that was his, he owned it. The wives, the children, he could sell them if he wanted to. That was perfectly legitimate. He could dispose of them. He could lop their heads off if he felt that was okay, and nobody would ever do anything to him because he had absolute property rights. So this whole idea that we've come to accept all needs to be called into question. we actually have to start thinking about, well, what does this mean? I remember when territorial limits in the oceans were 3 miles. Well, those got thrown overboard back in the 70s and the 80s when everybody started, especially in here in Europe, when they started looking for fishing grounds because they'd fished out their 3 miles. Then it was 12, and then it was 200, depending on who it was, and then there's a dispute, and yeah, people are going, well, wait a minute, but we didn't do this, and we didn't do that, we don't have this, we don't have that, we didn't agree on this, yeah, but I'm going to do it, and it's a matter of assertion, and unfortunately, in situations of conflict, the person who is being perceived as the biggest bully usually gets his way. Why do you think we have disputes over diesel emissions in the United States and Germany? You know, because America decided, oh, you cheated us and you're actually polluting more than we are. So we have a right to, you know, and I don't know if you're aware that most of the German auto manufacturers are being pressured and being disproportionately punished for things that Americans do because they're foreigners. That happens because you're doing it to us, or this whole, you know, so we need to be rethinking a whole lot of things. And this is what I hear John Marco saying. We need to be rethinking a lot of things, and we're not rethinking anything. And our presidential candidates or the people that are interviewing them aren't rethinking them anyway. So we need to also be looking, this is another thing I John said repeatedly, we have to be looking for different people that we can ally with, that we can start doing that and perhaps having an effect on something. Because it's not going to happen, if you ask me, politically. That's the last place, as far as I'm concerned, anything's going to happen. But that's just my two cents.
I appreciate that, Ed. I'm actually, I think the artists get there first, then the scientists, and then the politicians are the last to get the news. And I think that's and I think to some extent we're all, you know, I love science, I love the arts, I love music, I love history. I mean, we're all students of many different disciplines, and I believe the value of coming together, reading a difficult text or thinking about a candidate for president, I mean, these are kind of exercises in collaboration. How can we, from different walks of life and different orientations, different experiences, create a coherent we space rather than a food fight, which I think we're all very familiar with, people throwing things at each other. So, but I do believe that a coherent enough we space, if there are enough of them, we can create the conditions for a new kind of politics. And I believe the opportunities are enormous right now because there's so much widespread malaise and disappointment with the current situation. I've never seen it this bad. And when it gets this bad, people start coming together in ways they would not do if the status quo was fine. Who cares who's the president, you know, or who's in Congress? I'm doing okay. Most people I know are not doing okay. And even those who have maybe temporarily a lot more revenue than others, they're not feeling tremendous satisfaction with the status quo either. So my feeling is, you're talking about identity earlier, Ed, I think our identities are mostly invisible to us until we are violated in some way. You know, I get along with everybody until someone steps on my toe. And then I scream. And I think that's the way many of us are. But there are also psychic boundaries that get violated. And I used to identify with being a New Yorker. I identify with being gay. I had a previous identity as a Southerner. I still am a Southerner, even though I don't primarily identify with that. I'm an American when I go to Paris. When I go to France, I feel like I'm an American. When I'm here, I don't feel like an American at all. I'm just a normal person. I'm aware that I'm a white person because of the relationships I've had with black people. I remember sitting in my living room. My boyfriend at the time was Afro-American. And this is my first, I just arrived in New York from the Deep South, where something like that was not possible. Everyone in the room was black, except for me. And I remember saying out loud, oh, you know, I ran into a white guy the other day. And I sort of paused because I had never described anyone in my life as a white guy. And I realized I was suddenly, when I was surrounded by black people, that I was a white person. This was news to me. And I think if you're moving in many different kinds of social spaces, as I have in my life, you start to realize, oh, that's an identity I did not know that I had. And so I think the identities can be useful. And I believe we cannot thrive, I believe, culturally as a complex, on a very complex and unstable planet that we're living on, if we're not able to be flexible with our identities and let go of them, hold them, let go of them, find another identity. This group of people has their identity. I have my identity. What's in between us that could be useful for both of us? And I think we're not there yet. We've had some tremendous successes. I think the gay movement is an example of a social success story, as many more gay people are, the burdens that have been lifted because of persons like me who registered the agony of being ostracized as a group. We got together and we worked on it. And we took lots of chances. We broke the law, we changed the law. And I believe that this is a good thing. And I believe we got to do more of it, and we have to do it on purpose. And this is not going to be easy, but I think our experiments here, if we have a space where we can experiment in a safe to fail way, we can accelerate our learning together and move forward with multiple agendas. Because I'm for triangulating at the margins, and the margins are very fluid. There's more than one margin that we're operating with. So thank you once again.
It's interesting, John, that if I heard you right, you started off that our identity is brought to our attention by somebody crossing a boundary. Is that right?
Partially, I believe that's true. We're usually unconscious of identities unless someone bumps into us.
I think that's actually part of the way of our identity comes even through childhood, but we unconsciously stored in our nervous system those breaks that may not have been intentional. I mean, it's just our nervous system responding to our caretakers and our environment. But I want to just say that I like the fact that you stretched it out, that we also, if we acknowledge that and work with that, then our sense of identity can be flexible. And to the degree that we understand we have a defense system around of our identity, but how flexible is it? Because, you know, in my experience from where I've come from, what I had to learn is most of the time, I had to discern most of the time people weren't necessarily intentionally trying to fuck with me. I just was so hypersensitive because of my trauma, hypervigilant, that I had to dial back and distinguish when there is, it's like I had to come up with the ethics of not worrying about whether it's a real threat or a perceived threat, just ethics of how to respond to a threat. And then I could kind of sort it out, if that makes sense. Does that make sense, John?
Yes, it does. Thank you. That's very clear. I think it's the wonderful thing about it, if we can deal with the ambiguities of our identity together.
Right.
And then I believe, and that personal pronoun I is extremely vital. We don't want to get rid of it. But I think there's a way of us communicating with one another that can go beyond ego to ego.
Right. Yeah, because then the personal pronoun I becomes more fluid and porous, but there's still protection. There's still a sort of an updated version versus a child unconscious of protection.
That's right. I couldn't say that better. Thank you. So it is personal and it's beyond the personal.
Yes.
And these previous identities, which had a benefit, may no longer have a benefit.
Exactly.
Think about a wounded child to reenact that is not appropriate now.
Yeah.
And so we can change. But when you bring your awareness to that dynamic, you change that dynamic.
And you socially have people around you to help you. And I've had people help me understand that distinction.
Yes.
And this still goes, this ties into economics, because what we're talking about, because I, as much as I agree with Ed that it's not going to be solved in the big political fuckhead mentality, the politics in the sense of the social currency that we share on the ground, like here, or when I go out and interact with people, I'm very political in the sense that I'm sensitive of how we politically talk about ideas and where we stand and where we're at. And sometimes I fuck up. Sometimes, like the other day, I had a person that I was trying to explain something and I felt marginalized. I said, why do you dismiss what I said? But I said it with not an attack,
right,
but just a clear statement.
I could respond to that, but I want to offer others an opportunity to chime in if you're aware of that. I think that being triggered by another person and being able to say, I'm triggered, is an opportunity for the cognitive, the somatic intelligence, the gut, to realign in a relational space.
And teach each other we can talk through it.
Right, right. And that's not easy when we're triggered.
No.
And I think that that's what these political events tend to be about. We're just taking our traumas and using them as an excuse to re-traumatize one another.
Like picking a scab, like one friend said.
Yeah. And I just want to tell a brief story and then I'll shut up. But there's I think I've told this before. I mentioned it on the call with Davor, talking about the trauma, the effects of trauma, and what we now know about trauma, and how there's a great deal of hope that we can retrain our attention and release the effects of trauma so that we're not dissociating from or diving into and reactivating the traumatic episodes. And I remember this terrible story of, I hear a lot of background. Can someone mute themselves, or is that me? Yeah, anyway, I just want to tell this briefly. A horrible story, a busload of children were kidnapped. The kidnappers, it was in California, out in the desert, the kidnappers, they buried the bus in a sand pit and abandoned them. And the children reported, because there's a lot of therapists studied this particular case because they wanted to know how these children who were rescued, how they perceived that event. Because there's many who claim that there's a lot of fabrication going on in trauma, and there's a play of memory and imagination that makes reports from traumatized people very suspicious. And so how do we look at trauma in a coherent way? How can we create therapies that work? And what they observed in this group of children, who everyone agreed this was a very traumatic episode, they all were rescued. But what happened? And they all reported the same thing, that after the bus had been buried and the sand was starting to come in, that the pressure on the top of the bus started to break open. And so, and they froze. except for two boys. And the two boys got everyone together somehow miraculously, I would say magically, got everybody out. So all the children got back to safety and they reported the same story. But I think it's hopeful that that fight, flight, freeze pattern is not inevitable. This comes from our mammalian, well, actually our reptilian, the reptilian aspect of our nature. Fight, flight, and freeze is good for a reptile. It's fatal for a human being. Because when we freeze, we shut down our autonomic nervous system. And this can kill us. So I think this is something that we can retrain, that it isn't inevitable that we reactivate this fight, flight, freeze pattern in our nervous system. And that what we're learning about in polyvagal therapy is what they're calling it. Stephen Porges and there's many other researchers who looked at this, that there's a new kind of social system that is evolutionary, that we have a capacity for once we retrain our vagus nerve, which is that nerve that moves from the back of our spine, back of our neck through our spine into our viscera, up into the throat, up into the eyes. So we can look someone in the eyes, we can hear their voice, we can get in touch with where they are in their own body. We have much higher degrees of empathy and we can share an intelligence, which is much vaster than when a person is shutting down in that fight, flight, freeze pattern, which I think is what US politics, and probably most politics right now, tends to reactivate. So thanks.
That's called biohacking in the awakened ape. It's actually digging deep into the biology and understanding that we can learn a lot if we expand our understanding of our own biology. And I think some of this is a component. If we're going to work with these economics and these mass scales, this is a component of, because everybody right now is showing signs of trauma in some way, even whether they want to admit it or not. And I don't want to make catastrophe, but I think some of the reasons we don't even move forward and think deeply, like Ed points out, is the trauma is keeping us from thinking deeply. And we have to take that step of untraumatized so we can be comfortable with thinking deeply, because that's a new layer of learning, you know, I don't know what you want to call it, but it's a new layer of learning that's highly possible from my point of view.
I would call that quantum biology. I think we're moving into a quantum coherence.
Because there is some kind of specific way that we can do it, but we have, I think from my experience, part of it is, and I like the way you put it, John, is bringing the social aspect in a healthy way. Because I think one of the problems we have with social changes is, I grew up with my father being an Ayn Rand disciple, and everything was about just me and herd mentality. So I think we have this ambiguity about social and herd mentality, rightfully so. I don't want to dismiss it, but I think we also have taken it to such an extreme and made it an absolute that even in nature, animals get along, groups get along. They have their differences, but this black and white of turning our social part of our brain into just gravitating to the herd mentality of the social network of our brain is not helping. We need to understand the limits of that, and it is a legitimate concern, but we got to break out of that too. Love you guys.
Would you like to chime in, Marco? If you're able to.
Hey, sorry about that. I don't have a lot to say other than that that behavior, the pattern that John noted in the boys is observed in any kind of crisis or emergency situation. And there's usually a few people that can keep their cool or who wake up out of the trance, the fight, freeze, flight kind of reaction, and are able to look at the situation objectively. And, you know, I don't mean that in the scientific rational sense, I just mean in a very practical sense. And there are a lot of people who I think are, you know, albeit with coming from different points of view and, you know, not without their own traumas and their own reenactments of shadow or however you want to frame that, but who they are seeing that there is a meta problem, and that, you know, it's a problem that has multiple scales. It's from the planetary to the individual to the interior, and those reflect each other. So I think that I like quantum politics. I think that's catchy. I'm not sure if it will catch on. But what I think it points to is this, it's a different kind of thinking, because it means thinking simultaneously at multiple scales and from multiple perspectives, and not necessarily privileging or not always privileging one perspective or scale or another, but being able to hold them, and not only to hold them in one's own individual, you know, awareness or in relationships, but then also to hold up that quantum perspective and at the same time respond, effectively to the observed actual situation. I mean, there's multiple levels to this, because existentially we're all going to die. You know, our individual body minds are not going to, you know, perpetually live. And there may be some technological kind of enhancements that allow for a body to, but if it, I mean, I think it's a core metaphysical truth. If it has a beginning in time, it has an end in time. So just if we were to look at like that depth of thinking, we would have to deal with our own mortality as part of any quantum politics. Apart from questions about the biosphere and, you know, the apocalypse, the climate apocalypse, like if we don't have if we're not conversant with or we're not able to like negotiate and navigate the facts of life, then everything else that we might look at is going to be skewed by our own hang-ups around, you know, embodiment. So, what a politics looks like, that maybe UBI is appropriate because it has, it's a neurologically an effective intervention in the larger social body. And maybe it isn't. I don't think I haven't thought about it deeply enough to have an informed opinion on that. But I think that what we're kind of saying is that like everything is on the table, because everything is relevant actually to what, you know, to how, not to just get into generality, but like every scale and every perspective is relevant to the whole. I mean, that's just, I think that gets into the metaphysics of like how we fundamentally construct the world or represent the world or engage in the world. And we don't even have the language exactly for it. And so I think, yeah, having artists involved and scientists and people of action, people that can pragmatically create policies and influence, you know, influence a population for the greater good, for their own, you know, for their own and our own good. I think that has to be the future. And I think, you know, like a lot for beauty, you know, beauty can be used for political ends or for economic ends. but it's always degraded, or it's often usually degraded when it is. And, you know, if we had a worldview, and if this were sort of like the operating system that, you know, most or many humans kind of walked around with, that beauty is as important as truth and goodness, and that, you know, and that certain kinds of ways that you frame an experience or a product or whatever it is actually degrade its beauty, because if everything has a price tag, if everything has to justify its existence in economic terms, that's inherently ugly. So even something that's beautiful in an ugly framework kind of loses a little bit of its luster. And I think that, you know, even if an artist isn't politically taking a specific position, they could be having a profound political effect because of the way that they choose to frame or not frame an experience. I think that's all I really want to say about that. I appreciate this conversation a lot. And I'm, you know, feel torn because I'm supposed to be working and making money right now. But I think this has been a better use of my time. Thank you again.
So we're approaching the 2-hour milestone, as we usually do. So I'll make this my closing comment. But what Derwin just posted a little bit ago, a book by Rutger Bregman that I had, I think, browsed through before, called Utopia for Realists, which is another book and author that introduces basic income, universal basic income, as the most logical way forward, maybe not logical way forward, but a realistic opportunity that includes the mass of people, perhaps in just one country. But when I hear the word utopia and for realists, and when I was first introduced to philosophy and or just philosophical thought, that the idea of utopia was introduced to me. I didn't have parents that introduced these ideas, so it was first introduced when I attended a first-year philosophy course, and my feeble mind started thinking, oh, well, what would a utopia look like for the individual, for myself even? It's always torn between the 10 million things that sway me in one direction or another, and there's whether you're a Freudian with the superego, the id, and the ego, or someone who sees sub-personalities, multiple personalities that each of us carry with us. There's a politics that needs to happen within our own selves, and the idea of quantum politics. Perhaps that's where I'm at now that I've tried forcing myself in multiple ways to do things, and that always backfires. There's the Dionysian nighttime Doug that gets bitched at by morning time Doug that needs to get back to work or procrastinated, and so there's that divide there. And being a dictator for myself doesn't work. Being completely reasonable or lax, laissez-faire, doesn't always work either. There's stuff that needs to get done. There needs to be a meeting ground for all these personalities, or the ruler on top needs to be benevolent enough to accommodate for everyone else. So, as I provide myself with quantum politics, as I understand what's been discussed here, to scale that larger and larger takes quite a lot of voices, quite a lot of sharing of stories, of uses of imagination. So as always, I appreciate the ideas that have been sown here, and I'll carry it forth in my day. So thank you.
I want to bring in, at least for myself, the notion of spirituality that does contain religion, in the sense that I think religion does have within it some things to add to the table, in the sense, simple sense for me in my Zen practice is bringing forth certain qualities of equanimity and loving kindness for myself, so that I can give it to others in terms of dealing with people that may be triggering me or me getting triggered. The practices of equanimity and loving kindness, and in Zen, it's just shut up and listen to what's happening, you know, before you respond, non-defensive listening. I think there's a component for that. If we can, I have at least at this point, kind of sorted the wheat from the chaff. I grew up Episcopalian. I don't like a lot of the religious organization and powers, but within it, what I grew up with, Jesus to this day is still a mentor of making sense and making meaning in the midst of my own life. And it's helped me be open in a non-perspectival way, if possible, but it is a practice from my point of view. So, you know, I think that's a thing that's part of the table, that needs to be put on the table, is that aspect of how we make sense and how we make meaning about all the things that we're trying to sort out on the table.
Hey, Michael, I know that there are some closing comments, but I just was reminded of that, a similar story to the one John shared. The boys, were they Thailand or Indonesia, who were trapped in a cave that flooded?
Yeah, about earlier last year. Yeah, last year.
A similar kind of situation, but part of what saved them is that their coach, it was a soccer team, they all practice meditation.
Yeah.
And so that's how they, that's probably had a big role to play in keeping them from using up their oxygen, using up the scant resources that they had, and buying themselves time to get saved.
So,
I mean, to me, that's just really practical training for, for existing in any kind of crisis situation, but of course in daily life. Thanks for that.
And that's part of the body inquiry, I think, in terms of meditation, Marco, is that, and I use meditation in the broadest sense. It's not necessarily sit down. I think, you know, there's many kinds. It's like a sport, but anything that's helping you bring awareness to your own physiology and body as you're in the midst of activity is going to help you in the midst of crisis, from my point of view.
Yeah.
I know we're getting ready to wrap up, so I just wanted to recommend a book by Jeffrey Kripal, his new book, The Flip, Epiphanies of Mind and the Future of Knowledge. I think it's a real must read if you've flipped. I think many of us on this call may have. And if you have, you know you're in good company. I just wanted to share this one final section of this dream I had last night. This is about healing the split between mind, body, psyche, soma, self, other. And I think Kripal says, and I think he does an excellent job of looking at this philosophically, that we are all split. We are the split between these different levels. And I hear a voice in this dream. From behind me, I hear voices. I turn and I look, and I see a man's face, looking directly at me. And he says, "Do you want a mirror?" I said, "No, I want to watch TV, which is right behind you. Could you get out of my way?" So he says, "Where do you want the TV to go?" And so we spend some time moving the TV around this room, and then we both sit side by side and we watch the TV together. And on the TV, there's a program. There is a symbol. It's a combination of letters. It looks Roman to me. And I hear a voice, which is sounds Latin to me. And I start to float. And this fellow floats with me. And he's holding my thumb in the palm of his hand. And I feel this strange sort of shared reality. And I say to him that when I see that symbol and hear that voice, I feel the presence of an architecture. And this is a vast architecture. it's like the pyramids, the Roman aqueducts, you know, the 9/11, the building, the two twin towers, it's Notre Dame, it's gigantic. And I sense that this is a shared understanding. And I get the feeling that he's my daemon. He is myself on the other side of the split. Right now I'm on the other side of that split where I knew him and was in rapport with him. He's no longer a mirror. I'm no longer looking in the mirror. We're side by side. And we're looking at this technology. We're using this technology. We're working with symbols. And that's my big project, I think, for the brief time that I have left here on this planet. I want to figure out what a symbol is. I'm not sure I know. But I think if there were enough of us who could register the power of the symbols and in the synesthesias that occur when the vocal and the symbolic are entrained. I mean, we're all responding to these symbols. Look at what happened in Notre Dame when it burned down. It had a visceral effect on most of us. So I think where does the Cathedral of Notre Dame go now that it's been burned to the ground? Except for some of the structure, I think will remain. Some people want to rebuild it. And then what happens? So I just want to make a claim that our imaginations are not just subjective responses, but that our imaginations have an objective component. They're widely shared. And anyway, that's my spiel. Thank you for this opportunity. It's been a great conversation. A lot to think about.
Any final comments, Mark? None? Okay. I really appreciate the conversation because it reminds me that we are where we are, wherever we are, whenever we are, and we only do what we can do within the limits of what we think we can. And therein lies the problem. We don't trust ourselves enough to think beyond where we are, when we are, where we are, that there might be other options. And I believe firmly there are other options, but it's damn difficult to get other people to listen to what you think might be options.
Unless you play a good harmonica.
Okay, I'm working on it. We ain't there yet. Okay.
Well, you know, the only way you get them to listen is tune in to using your voice and seeing it and getting feedback if they're listening or not. don't give up the opportunity. That's been my mantra since for a long time. I agree with you. I have to be really sensitive and selective because I can tell when somebody's not listening.
That describes most of my day.
Yeah. My problem has been not to get butt hurt because they're not listening, because I'm going, my voice is back. My voice is back.
I think there's a lot we could incorporate from capitalism. If it's not the overriding kind of program that we're running, like Henry Ford, I think, was the one who said, whether you believe you can, or no, we said, whether you think you can or you think you can't, you're right. And you know, it's kind of a motivational wisdom nugget, but I think that it also expresses something that has metaphysical validity and truth to it. That there's really that rift in the rift that we, I think, that is open to radically different futures and kind of sees through the world, the current world, like what's on TV. There can be another channel. There could be another show after this one. And, you know, we get locked into particular time frames, in particular ways of framing what is real, what's not, what's present, what's absent, what's past, what's future. And I love what art does is play with that and reconfigure it and offer new vistas. But then if art wasn't just a subjective or wasn't just entertainment, if it really had a role to play in the ecology of culture, it becomes practical to be utopian. I think that that's a much more compelling direction to go in than, what is offered through what we call culture now. I think that it's possible to have a much richer culture, a much, much more fulfilling culture. And I think that culture comes, it's a living thing. It comes from small seeds, small germination, small gestures, and goes from there. So I thought I had made my last statement. That's the addendum.
Excellent, Marco. Yeah. I like what you said. Working metaphor for me is I planted seeds. Now I gotta pay attention and help them grow. You know, the seeds in me too. I mean, I have seeds in me that I'm trying to nurture forward. And this format, platform, whatever you want to call it, has been most helpful. So thank you for inspiring the artist in me.
It's been fun. Before we say goodbye, I had a chance to listen to Mark and Michael, your conversation about music. Woo! I think that applies here to where it's impossible to pay attention to all the different musical voices out there, but it's good enough to just know that it's going on in the background, that things are humming along. I like a lot of what the two of you worked on there. I'm glad it's finally available. But
yeah, we had a good jazz session, huh, Mark?
Thank you all.
Thank you, everyone, for this conversation.
See you next time.
Is everybody gone?